U.S. Senator Susan Collins discusses the president's cabinet appointments, alleged Russian hacking, and her legislative priorities in this Congress. Right now, Senator Susan Collins finds herself on many levels in the eye of the storm. As a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Collins is involved in a broad investigation into alleged Russian interference in the U.S. presidential election. She has also made herself an important voice in the discussions about the future of health care in the country. Last month, Collins outlined a plan for replacing the ACA, which she co-authored with three other U.S. senators. And she is the only Republican senator to vote against two of President Trump's cabinet nominees. Yet she's facing criticism for not blocking one of those nominees in committee. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Senator Susan Collins joins us in the studio today, and we are live streaming the program on the Maine Calling website, our Facebook page, and at mainepublic.org. Maine Calling is next, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios in Bangor, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Susan Collins was first elected to the United States Senate in 1996. As one of the few moderate Republican senators, she has found herself in the middle of many legislative battles. And today she's with me to discuss the new administration and its priorities and cabinet appointments, her plan to replace Obamacare, and her work to combat senior fraud, among other things. Senator Collins, welcome back to Maine Calling.
Thank you. It's great to join you.
And we should note that we are coming to you from a rebuilt studio. Our engineers have been working hard, and we are hopefully sounding even better than the last time Senator Collins joined us from our Bangor studio. As always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have for Senator Susan Collins? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. We are live streaming today's program on the Maine Calling website and the Maine Calling Facebook page. Senator Collins, some people are excited about the Trump election, but many others are fearful about what's happening. What do you say to those, and I know you've been hearing from them, who are afraid and angry?
I have never seen our country so polarized and divided as it is right now. And that troubles me. What I say to people who come up to me, and they are many, and meet with me, stop me everywhere, and say that they are truly fearful, is that our country is based on a foundation of checks and balances. And that constitutional framework has served us well. An example is what we recently saw when President Trump issued his executive orders that would have, in my judgment, imposed a religious test on prioritizing refugees who could come to this country, plus put an absolute ban on refugees coming for a certain amount of time, and a permanent ban on refugees from Syria. Now, we do need to do a better job of vetting those who are coming from conflict areas into our country to make sure that terrorists are not embedding themselves in the flood of refugees. But I strongly oppose the overreach of the president's executive order, which would have prevented, for example, Iraqi translators who helped save the lives of our troops in Iraq from coming to this country, despite the fact that their own lives are at risk if they stay in Iraq. Originally, it also applied to permanent legal residents of the United States, and that was a totally inappropriate provision. So what happened in this case? The Ninth Circuit stepped in and stayed the application of the executive order. Two other courts ruled as well. And I think it's an example of the brilliance of the founding fathers, that they built in the separation of powers of the three branches of government that gives us this ability to check executive power.
The Senate Intelligence Committee, which you serve on, has launched a broad investigation into alleged Russian interference in the U.S. election and beyond. Senator Collins, if you determine that the Russians did influence the election and members of President Trump's staff, what would happen next? Is the election invalidated? Would the U.S. take action against Russia? What would you support?
Well, first of all, I supported President Obama's sanctions that were imposed, the additional sanctions that were imposed after the election, based on the intelligence we had of Russian attempts called active measures to influence public opinion and in that way interfere with our election. The Intelligence Committee, on which both Angus King and I serve, is doing an in-depth investigation that includes not just contacts between possible contacts between either campaign and Russian officials, but also Russia's cyber threats to our country, its hacking of databases, including that at the Democratic National Committee, and attempts at the Republican National Committee, and also our attempts by Russia to probe our natural gas pipelines, our critical infrastructure. This is a broad investigation. And I am confident that since it is a completely bipartisan investigation with full-time staff, that we will get to the bottom of this. And I will encourage that there'll be some public hearings as well as the closed hearings that we're doing now, and that we issue a report. It's too soon to speculate, in my view, what would happen if we found various scenarios, because we don't know yet what we're going to find. We had a two-hour briefing on Friday that was helpful. We've asked all of the agencies and campaign officials involved to preserve all documents, all emails, all text messages that could be in any way relevant to the investigation.
And are you confident that people will be honest and forthcoming with your committee?
Well, we have very experienced staff that have the top level of security clearances, and we have very aggressive committee members. And this is one where the Republican chairman, Richard Burr, is working hand in glove with the Democratic vice chairman. It's not even called the ranking minority member on this committee, Mark Warner. And all of us are determined to get the answers. And yes, I am confident. I am going to request, and many of the members will, that we call Mike Flynn, to come testify, the former National Security Advisor, and to testify before us. So we're not going to exclude anyone from our review, and it will be thorough, accurate, bipartisan, and in-depth.
Will you subpoena the president's tax records to see if there are any Russian connections?
I don't know whether we will need to do that. If it's necessary to get to the answers, then I suspect that we would. That would be the initial decision would be made by the chairman and the vice chairman. My hope is that we'll have a lot of voluntary cooperation. And keep in mind that in some ways this is a counterintelligence operation in many ways. And that's what our committee specializes in. We meet twice every week for an afternoon in which we receive reports from intelligence officials, some undercover, some the heads of the agencies. And we are used to probing in depth in this area.
All right. You're the only Republican senator to vote against two of President Trump's cabinet nominees, Scott Pruitt for EPA and Betsy DeVos for Department of Education. Yet there are many people who are angry that you did not block DeVos's nomination in committee. Many believe this was purely a political move. What do you say to them?
Well, I would say that they are wrong, that they're mistaken and don't understand the process. The fact is that the chairman of the committee could report Mrs. DeVos's nomination to the full Senate by three different ways, with a favorable recommendation, with no recommendation, or with a negative recommendation. And that has been done in the past. And there are many examples of that. That was done with John Tower, for example, and many administrations ago. But second, and perhaps more to the point, I believe that each and every senator should have the right to vote on a cabinet nominee. And this isn't a new position that I've adopted, despite what some of my ferocious critics are saying. This is a position that I've always held. In President Obama's administration, I voted to end cloture on two nominees, Secretary of Defense Hagel and Secretary of Labor Perez, even though I opposed them and voted against their confirmation. But that was because, as I explained at the time, I believe that the president is entitled to have each and every senator go on record on the nomination. And the fact is that I also led the opposition against the president's nominee for labor secretary. So I have given careful consideration to each and every nominee. There have been some excellent ones, which I've been happy to support, like General Mattis for Secretary of Defense, Elaine Chao for Secretary of Transportation. And then there have been ones, Scott Pruitt for EPA, Betsy DeVos for the Secretary of Education, and Andy Puzner for Labor Secretary, whom I opposed.
Senator Collins, where does this put you, though? There only is, if I'm remembering correctly, only four Republican senators who have opposed any of President Trump's nominees. You're the only one who's opposed two of them. Do you receive pressure from your colleagues in the Senate? Does this put you, are you fearful of being isolated in future discussions because of these stances?
It's obviously a very difficult decision to oppose a nominee for any president's cabinet, because I start with the premise that the president should be able to assemble his own team. It's only when I find that a nominee is really inappropriate for the post that I vote against them. I know that some of my Republican colleagues, and obviously some administration officials, aren't happy with my votes on, they wanted a united Republican vote. But I think by now they know that I do what I think is right and that I'm going to call them as I see them. When Betsy DeVos testified before the committee, I went into that hearing totally open-minded about her. I'd met with her in my office and had a pretty good meeting, but she had a very rocky confirmation hearing. And when I asked a question about the landmark 1975 law that guarantees a free and appropriate education to children with special needs, and it was evident from my question and others that she didn't know that that was a federal law. And when I also listened to her responses and asked her questions about rural schools, and it became evident to me that she lacked a complete understanding of the needs of public schools, and that is the core mission of the Department of Education, I just felt that I could not vote for her. And I, now that she's confirmed, I want to work with her and try to be of assistance to her, but I do not think she was a good choice.
We're speaking with U.S. Senator Susan Collins on Maine Calling. Senator Collins, a month ago, you introduced a plan to replace the Affordable Care Act. As I understand it, the plan gives states the option of retaining ACA coverage and the exchanges or creating their own alternative program that would combine high-deductible health care plans with a subsidized health savings account. What would this mean for Maine's health care exchanges?
It would depend on the decision that the state of Maine made. I suspect that the state of Maine would go with what we call the better choice. Maine has experienced a 22% increase in premiums on average on the exchange. It has had insurers leave the market, so there are fewer choices for consumers. And the co-op in Maine is on shaky financial grounds. In fact, of the 23 co-ops that were subsidized by the ACA, only five are still operating. Maine is one, but it has been suffering losses. So my goal is to expand choices for consumers, to dampen the increase in premiums, and to expand the number of individuals who are insured in this country. Despite the passage of the ACA, there are still nearly 30 million Americans without coverage. And I believe that our plan, which retains all of the consumer protections that are in the ACA, in other words, no medical underwriting for pre-existing conditions, although you do have to pay your premium, and you can stay on your parents' policy till age 26 if you're a young person. No lifetime caps, no annual caps, no discrimination based on sex or race or nationality. Coverage of mental health and substance abuse, which is such a huge issue in our state right now. Those protections stay in place regardless of the option that the state chooses. And under the Better Choice Plan, the ACA money would be available to fund health savings accounts that could be used for first dollar coverage and or for better insurance coverage if you don't like a high deductible plan paired with a health savings account. That money comes from the ACA pot, if you will. But we also do something that would be really helpful in this state. We say that states would get the Medicaid expansion money regardless of whether or not they chose to expand Medicaid. Maine did not. 32 states did so. And the problem is there's this group that I call the vulnerables who make too much money to qualify for Medicaid, but ironically enough, they don't make enough money to qualify for the subsidies on the exchanges.
So under your plan, would Maine be mandated to provide those people with that money?
Plans? They would be given that money, and the money would go into the health savings accounts and could be used for public health initiatives as well.
I know we have more questions about your plan for health care. I've already looked through some of the emails, so we'll get back to that. But before we go to a break, Senator Collins, not many politicians today are talking about poverty. Yet you've introduced legislation to tackle poverty. What would it do?
I feel so strongly about this issue. If you look at when Lyndon Johnson declared the war on poverty, and what the rate was then of Americans in poverty and what the rate is now, it's barely budged. And that means despite our best intentions and the expenditure of literally trillions of dollars, that we have not lifted families out of poverty and made them self-sufficient. So along with Martin Heinrich, a Democrat from New Mexico, I've proposed a new approach, and we call it the Two-Generation Economic Empowerment Act. It focuses on the whole family. So instead of just ensuring, for example, that a family is getting the food stamps that it may qualify for, we say, could the children benefit from early Head Start? Could the mom benefit from job training. What is it? What are the obstacles that are keeping these families in poverty generation after generation? And the John T. Gorman Foundation right here in Portland is doing really exciting work, pilot projects in Washington County, and they're going to start one up in Bangor too, to try to figure out what supports do families need to get out of this cycle of poverty. Our bill attempts to break down the silos among all the various programs, from low-income heating assistance to job training to Head Start, all of the to TANF, all of the poverty anti-poverty programs, to figure out what are the needs of the family and work to meet those needs so that your outcome in life doesn't depend on your zip code or the family in which you're born.
We do have to go to a break. What is the status of the bill? It's been introduced. Has it gone any further?
It's been introduced. There's great interest in it. I've talked to Maine's CAP agencies, Community Action Program agencies, about it. They're very excited about it because they believe they'd be better able to serve low-income Mainers. It's pending in committee right now. I hope we can at least get hearings going on it. And we're starting to raise public awareness by working with various advocacy groups and foundations.
All right. Well, we'll be right back with Senator Susan Collins. This is Maine Calling.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Mark Mazzetti, the New York Times Washington Investigations editor. He's worked on stories about the Trump campaign's communications with Russian intelligence, Russia's hacking of the 2016 election, and former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. Mazzetti spent 10 years covering national security for the Times. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. Maine Public is seeking an experienced HR professional to lead all the aspects of our human resources functions for our statewide public broadcasting organization. We're looking for an HR director who's passionate about the work and mission of public broadcasting and has deep experience in all aspects of employee and labor relations, benefit sourcing, performance management, and HR compliance. If you or someone you know has the experience and enthusiasm that will complement Maine Public's dynamic and talented workforce, there's more information and details on how to apply at our website, mainepublic.org.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Senator Susan Collins. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll start with the calls. We'll start with Keith in Raymond. Hi, Keith. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks very much. I'd first like to thank Senator Collins for her service and also for her independent and thoughtful approach to each issue. Senator, I think you're a good person and you have a lot to be proud of. But let me get at why I'm calling. The Russian investigation and the possible collusion and treason by Donald Trump and his team is foremost on my mind. I feel myself getting angrier by the day with this issue because I'm not getting resolution on it. And if I don't get a public, independent review, I'm not looking for a cheap or fast investigation here. If I don't get a public review where I have transparency into this, I'm only going to be further enraged. That's the problem here. I don't trust the Senate based on the last 8 years of what I've seen from them. And I'll take my answer off the air. I want to put in a second quick point. I think an estate tax at 75% above a certain number, you know, no tax up until, say, $5 million, and then 75% in that would really help to prevent these dynasties that are being built.
Okay, Keith, thanks for your question. So two questions, really. Do you trust that the Senate can indeed have an independent, transparent, and meaningful investigation?
Keith, I really do. I know this committee. I know the capabilities on it. It has some very liberal Democrats on it. It has a wide ideological viewpoint on it. It is the Republicans only have a one-seat margin, if that's of concern to you. And all of us, Republicans, Democrats, or Independents, or Green, have an interest in getting to the bottom of this. This is a very serious allegation. And it's not one that I or any member of the committee takes lightly. And that's why I think it is important that we not just have private briefings and private hearings, but public ones, and end up with a public report of our findings. I think otherwise, you're right, that it won't have credibility if everything is done behind closed doors. But we're in this initial phase right now. There are law enforcement implications, and we want to make sure that we're doing it right. But I can assure you that all of the members of the committee and the leadership of both armed services and of the Senate, both Democrat and Republican, are also ex officio members of the committee and sitting in on this as well. So there are a lot of eyes on the committee's work, and we care about this. This is incredibly serious. And I say that as someone who thinks President Putin is a thug and an authoritarian leader who has crushed democracy, not only in Russia, but seized Crimea and is threatening Ukraine and frightening Eastern Europe. So I'm concerned on a policy side about the president's remarks about Putin. On the estate tax issue, you've raised an interesting idea of a tiered approach. We are likely to do some kind of tax reform. What I have voted for in the past is having the kind of threshold that you talked about, not going clear up to 75%, but having a higher rate for those with a great deal of wealth. It's been interesting if you see some very rich individuals like Warren Buffett and Michael Bloomberg and Bill Gates are taking this pledge to give away all of their money rather than leave it to the next generation. So I think there's a change among some billionaires in their attitude toward this issue.
Thanks, Keith, for your call. We'll go to a tweet. Is it the job of Congress to hold the president accountable to ethics standards? If not, who?
Well, the Congress can pass laws that would bind the executive branch, and indeed we do. For example, the Office of Government Ethics has to do a review of each and every official that is subject to confirmation by the Senate. And we get a letter from the Office of Government Ethics that certifies whether cabinet members, for example, have met the standards for conflicts of interest. That's why you read about Rex Tillerson, for example, having to divest himself of his holdings. And the president files an annual report as well. But the president is not bound by all of the ethics laws that bind us as members of Congress. And I don't know whether that's a separation of powers issue or exactly why that is, but I believe it's a separation of powers issue.
All right. Let's see. Going to this is from Mark, who's a doctor. As the director of the Division of Rheumatology at Maine Medical Center and practicing rheumatologist in Portland for the past 35 years, I can attest to the significant barrier to care caused by effective medications that are unaffordable. How does your plan address this problem?
I'm very glad that the doctor asked that question, because last year, the major investigation done by the Aging Committee under my leadership and side by side with the ranking member, Claire McCaskill, Democrat of Missouri, was an investigation into the costs of prescription drugs that were off patent. Their patents had expired, and they were bought up by what I call these hedge fund pharmaceutical companies that did nothing and spent not a dime to develop the drug and then jacked up the price overnight, sometimes by as much as 5,000%. And I think this is immoral. I think that it is simply wrong. And when we interviewed one of the pharmaceutical executives from one of these hedge pharmaceutical people, we asked him why. He said, because I can. And it created huge hardships for patients, for hospitals, for healthcare providers. And what we have done is we put out a report in December, which didn't get the attention it deserved. And we went through our four case studies that we did. We interviewed hundreds of people. We reviewed literally hundreds of thousands of pages of documents that we subpoenaed from these four companies. And we came up with a series of recommendations. And one of them, which we've reintroduced this year, is to say to encourage more competition and more generic drugs to be made available. And what it does is it tells the FDA that if there is no generic competitor, that if someone files an application, they go to the head of the line, because the FDA approval process, even for generics, can be very backed up. And this year, we will likely at the end of the year be taking up a renewal of the generic drug law that has fees included in it. And that's going to be a perfect vehicle for us to add our bill to. Another problem we found is sometimes generic companies have a very difficult time getting sufficient quantities of the brand name drug so that they can duplicate it, because the brand name pharmaceutical will put the drug into a restricted distribution system. And I have talked with the head of the FDA about this, and this just isn't right. So that's another piece of legislation that I'm pushing. There are other things we could do.
So this is outside of your legislation for a replacement for the ACA. This is separate legislation. Thank you, Senator Collins. I want to ask you sort of a summary question. We've had many emails, many Facebook posts, and I'm sure there are people who are trying to call who want to know why you will not hold a town hall meeting. So for all of them, I will ask it now.
Sure. Well, first of all, let me say that I meet with literally thousands of constituents every single year. And in fact, the Maine Potato Board was just down last week, and they said that I'm the only member of the Maine delegation that has met with them every single time they have come to Washington. Yesterday, I met in Portland with a group of Muslim Americans living in the Portland area who wanted to talk about Donald Trump's position towards the Muslim community. We had a great meeting. This morning, I met with a group of family physicians who are concerned about repeal of the ACA and wanted more information on what I am proposing. I also met with a large group from MDI, retired foreign officers and military officials, and Jill Goldway, the former legislator. We had a great discussion as well on foreign policy and ACA and a whole host of issues. And right before I came over here, I met with a woman whose son suffers from serious mental illness, and she wanted to make sure that the bill I'm proposing would cover individuals who need mental health care, which it would. And so I meet with people all the time. I'd wager that I meet with more constituents than any member of the main congressional delegation. The reason that I am not high on doing town halls is that I had two of them my very first year in office. I thought, I'll try this. And in both cases, there were a few voices who dominated the entire thing, and the vast majority of people didn't get to say a word, and they were drowned out by just a few people. And I find that it's much more constructive for me to sit down with groups and talk to them one-on-one. And the group, ironically, that is leading this drive, I met with yesterday in Augusta, and it was live streamed. What is this but a town hall? I don't know what questions are coming in. You've solicited them, come up with some that you think are representative. This is the equivalent. And so I would finally note that it has not been the tradition of Maine senators to hold town hall meetings because they've had the same experiences that I have, that one-on-one interactions with constituents are more productive. So George Mitchell, Bill Cohen, Olympia Snowe, and Angus King have not helped them.
Let me ask you this. If some listening, though, and has already heard that twice a week you spend an entire afternoon with the Senate Intelligence Committee, that you have an incredibly packed schedule, how do you get on Susan Collins' calendar if your group really wants to talk to you?
The way that you do it is on our website. There you can request an appointment. And that's how all the people that I've talked to you about, that I've met with today and yesterday, that's how they got appointments. At times, my staff will help out and meet with people as well. We also do constituent coffees during the very busy times of the year, where I will meet with groups that are coming down. We have school groups that come down. I've also would make the point, you know, I did a forum here in Bangor that AARP held that was open to the public at Hudson University. And people came and talked to me about a whole host of issues. I spoke at Bates. I spoke at Bowdoin. It's not like I'm not out there. I've visited more than 200 schools in Maine. So I have a great deal of valuable input from my constituents, which I value.
We do have to go to another break. We're talking with U.S. Senator Susan Collins. This is Maine Calling.
Our Maine Public Classical Channel is now heard in 5 locations around Maine: Bangor, Waterville, Fryeburg, Bridgeton, Portland, and Millbridge MDI. Just about 24/7 classical music, including Robin Rillette's morning classical music program, the Saturday afternoon opera, and our weekday evening concert series with orchestras from Boston, Chicago, and New York, along with Main Stage and its terrific performances from stages and organizations around our state. For more information about Maine Public Classical, see your Experience member magazine or visit mainepublic.org. Join us at 2 o'clock following Maine Calling today for World Affairs Council. Today's speaker is author Dan Slater. He'll discuss the Mexican drug cartels and U.S.-Mexican drug wars. That's World Affairs Council coming up at 2 o'clock following Maine Calling here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling today on the program, Senator Susan Collins. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. We will go to another call. This is Bob calling from South Portland. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much, Jennifer. Hi there, Senator Collins. Senator, I know you're getting calls about the ACA and all these things that I care about, too, but I wanted to bring up something that doesn't get talked about enough with senators, and that's the policy towards our native wildlife. Right now, the last president and his Fish and Wildlife Director were not particularly friendly to wildlife, but they did in August, and I'm going to be quick, they did in August forbid the aerial slaughter but through airplanes and helicopters, of bears and wolves on national wildlife refuges. And they studied this in Alaska, where these animals have been persecuted. These are on national wildlife refuges that are owned by the American people, not by the states.
Bob, can you ask your question quickly?
Yes.
Thank you.
One of the things that the House did, and it's soon coming to the Senate, is they made a priority of overruling this protective, ecologically sound, ethical...
Okay. Senator Collins, what's your position on this bill?
To tell the truth, this is a new issue for me. So I'm hesitant to give an off-the-top-of-my-head response, but it sounds like if we're talking about using planes to spot wildlife, I don't like that practice in a national refuge. And my inclination would be that I would not vote to overturn that regulation. Having said that, that's based on Bob's description to me. Not that I'm doubting Bob's description, but it's just not an issue that I'm familiar with. But I don't think it's fair to have to use aerial surveillance to find the game on a national refuge. That doesn't sound right to me.
Well, Bob, thanks for your call. A Facebook question from Nancy. Senator Collins, how will you address the dangers of climate change for Maine fishermen, farmers, and for all of us under the Trump administration?
Well, Nancy is right that climate change poses a real threat to many of our traditional industries. The Gulf of Maine's aquatic life, Casco Bay's aquatic life has really changed. We're seeing different kinds of crabs coming into our state that previously were unknown in Casco Bay, and that is a result of the warming of the waters. And, of course, we're a coastal state, so that there are implications for waterfront property and also for public health. Lyme disease used to be unknown in the state of Maine. Now it is in all 16 counties. It's finally reached, unfortunately, Aroostook County as well. And that is also a consequence of climate change. This administration's choice of Scott Pruitt to be the head of EPA concerns me because he has been in the forefront of trying to overturn the Clean Power Plan, which put new emissions controls on coal-fired power plants, some of the worst polluters. And even though we don't have coal-fired power plants in Maine, we get the emissions are blown in from out of state. And it causes us to have some of the highest asthma rates in the nation as well. So I am confident that there are going to be attempts to completely scale back or overturn those regulations. Now, do I agree with everything the EPA has done? Absolutely not. I disagree with them on their change of heart on biomass, for example. But I have voted to sustain EPA's ability to regulate greenhouse gases, and I will continue to do so. I also have a bill with a senator from Connecticut, Smurphy, that's aimed at short-acting but very powerful greenhouse gases. And I have a bill with Dick Durbin of Illinois that's aimed at giving clean cook stoves to African and countries where they're burning dung and other very sooty materials, and they're responsible for a staggering amount of the soot that is in our atmosphere and drifts over. So if we could help for a very nominal amount of money replace those dirty cook stoves with solar-paneled cook stoves, for example, or other clean cook stoves, we not only would improve the health of the families that are using them, but we would also help to reduce the soot that's in our atmosphere.
I want to circle back to something I mentioned at the very top of the show, but we're almost out of time, so I want to make sure that I don't forget to ask you about your work on fraud and especially senior fraud. I understand in the past year, since a hotline number has been set up, you have heard from very many Mainers.
We have. We've heard from people from every state in the nation. We had 2,300 calls last year, but the majority of the calls are from the state of Maine. And since this is IRS time, the one fraud that I really want to alert people to is what's known as the IRS imposter fraud. It's the largest scam in IRS's history. And what happens is someone calls up pretending to be an IRS agent, and they tend to target seniors, and they say to the senior, you owe thousands of dollars in unpaid taxes. And if you don't pay up, we're coming, we're sending the police to arrest you or the marshal to come get you, or we're going to seize your home or foreclose on you or put a lien on your property, really frightening people, not just seniors, but anyone who gets that kind of call from the IRS. And I would tell people that the IRS is not going to call you up out of the blue and tell you that you owe taxes and that you should go buy an iTunes card or some kind of debit card and come back and read them the numbers. That is never how the IRS operates. If you truly owe back taxes, the IRS will have written you a letter and you would have the opportunity to contest the amount, to appeal it if you disagree with it, and a payment plan if, in fact, you owe the taxes. So if you get one of these calls, the best advice that I can give you is to hang up the phone. Seniors lose $2.9 billion a year to scams such as this one.
And we will put the number, the IRS hotline, fraud hotline number on our MPBN Maine Calling Facebook page. I'm going to try to squeeze in a couple more calls if possible. This is Dwight in Booth Bay. Hi, Dwight. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. My question to the senator is, what are you going to do to remove Steve Bannon and Stephen Miller from the White House?
I have absolutely no control over the existence of Steve Bannon and Stephen Miller in the White House, because unlike cabinet officials, where I can vote against them or I can call them to testify before us, we have no control over the president's personal staff, and the individuals are both on his personal staff. Now, let me say something that I've spoken now very strongly against, and that is the president's decision to put Steve Bannon on the National Security Council. I think this is a terrible mistake, and he is downgrading the role of the head of the CIA and the Director of National Intelligence. Director of National Intelligence nominee is Dan Coats. He's a good friend of mine, a former senator from Indiana, an experienced diplomat as well as a former ambassador to Germany, and he used to be a member of the Intelligence Committee. His nomination hearing will be coming up either next week or the week after, and I'm going to ask him specifically about this issue because I find it deeply disturbing.
We have an email from Lou. The Bangor Daily News is breaking a story at this hour that Governor LePage has asked President Trump to rescind the Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument that was created under President Obama last August. Does the senator support keeping the new monument in place?
Well, first of all, let me say that I thought that President Obama should not have issued the executive order creating the monument, that particularly in light of the opposition of the state legislature and several of the towns in the area. I think that's something that should have been left up to Congress to do. However, once it is issued, there is a real legal question about whether a subsequent president can undo the designation. And at this point, I also think that many of the towns that are being affected have started to work together to make the best of this situation. So I don't think the president has the legal authority to rescind it based on work that we had the Congressional Research Service do on that very issue. And at this point, I think the majority of the people in the area, not everyone by any means, but former opponents have said to me, let's at this point see if we can put it together. What I think is far more important is an effort that Angus King and I have led to have an economic development assessment team come to Maine and work with all the stakeholders, from landowners to loggers to mill owners to recreational business owners, to come up with a plan for our forest products industry to help in this transition where we've lost so many of our pulp and paper mills in the last 5 years. And we still have this wonderful asset, this wood basket. And I think we can find niches, as some of the more creative surviving mills have done, and help keep the forest products industry thriving. And that's what I think our goal and focus should be.
Senator Collins, I have to end with a question that I suspect you're not going to be looking forward to, but I know a lot of people are speculating about the governor's race in 2 years. Are you considering a run for governor?
There have been many people who have encouraged me to consider running for governor. And I'm looking at how I could best serve the people of Maine. And I'm not ruling it in, and I'm not ruling it out. I just feel like I am too busy, and it's too early to be thinking about it in depth.
It's less than 2 years.
I know, but boy, have you noticed how busy it's been lately in Washington and here in Maine?
Well, Senator Susan Collins, thank you so much for returning to Maine Calling. We look forward to having you back. We apologize to most of the questioners who didn't get their questions through because we did only have an hour, but we do appreciate you being here today and look forward to welcoming you back to this beautiful studio.
Thank you so much.
And we need to give some thanks to John Keimel, who ran the board today, Nick Woodward, Nick Godfrey, Dave Bartlett, George Thomas, who helped us out here in Bangor. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, join host Keith Shortall for a conversation about the latest advances in veterinary care. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.